Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a return guest, somebody who I enjoyed having on last time and learned a lot from. And I think with our economy in the way it's going, I think we need to speak with an expert. Today we're going to speak with Dr. Daniel Sutter. He's the Charles G. Koch Professor of Economics with the Manuel H. Johnson Center for Political Economy at Troy University and is a PhD graduate of George Mason University. His research has examined the societal impacts of extreme weather, the economics of the news media and media bias, the markets for economists, economic research, environmental regulation, and constitutional economics. He's published over 100 articles in scholarly journals in economics, atmospheric sciences, civil engineering, and political science, and written and edited 4 books. He writes a weekly column in economics and public policy for yellowhammer.com and Alabama Today, and a monthly column on Alabama economics and policy for 1819 News. He's the host of E-Conversations on Troy University's Trojan Vision television channel, a show examining economic and policy questions. He's also the policy advisor for the Heartland Institute. So, Dr. Sutter, I want to thank you so much for joining me because I think this is a timely conversation since we've had a lot of, drama, but topics of conversation about economy, and either it's awesome or it's not, or we're looking for the next shoe to fall. And I'm so glad to have you back on in order to explain what's going on so we can be better versed.
Well, Dr. George, I'm happy to be on. I was glad to be on before and happy to talk about these issues with you here today.
Oh, awesome. Let's start off with the burning question about inflation. First of all, what is inflation?
Well, economists would say, when we want to think about a pure inflation would be an increase in all prices, more or less simultaneously. And that would be driven in almost all cases simply by an increase in the money supply. That's the most likely explanation for that. So if all prices were to go up by 10%, and including like not just prices of energy, food, shelter, and all the things that you buy, but also wages and salaries, because those are prices as well. They're prices of labor. And so a pure inflation would be a 10% rise in all of these prices at basically about the same time.
Is that what's gone on in the last several years?
Well, that's a good question. The 20 to 25% increase in prices since January of 2021 is, I think, to some extent, a mix of the two. There were clearly some, because an alternative to inflation would be a change in what we call relative prices. If, for instance, the price of energy becomes more expensive, and for instance, we had when Russia invaded Ukraine, there were potential disruptions of oil market because Russia produces a lot of oil. If there's an increase in, say, like energy prices, but not all prices in general, then we say that energy has become more expensive relative to other goods. And in the market, we would say, like, well, that's actually a signal for people to probably use less energy. And what we would say is we actually want that price of energy to rise relative to other goods because it's going to help give people an incentive to use less energy and conserve, because that's what the higher price is trying to show people. So we clearly have, and going back to like the COVID and then lockdown supply chain disruptions, there were clearly some things that have become more expensive, especially the goods that were in demand during COVID. Like one of the things is a big demand for computer chips because they're making a bunch of Google Chromebooks that were going to be used for remote schooling. Well, that put a tremendous pressure on those chips, and they weren't really available to put in cars and other things as well. And so there were clearly disruptions in the availability of some goods, and that was going to lead those goods to an increase in price. Now, the reason I say that is that when we go to measure prices, the consumer price index, which is our main measure for inflation, is an average price level. If you have the prices of some goods rising and others don't fall, so we have this change in relative prices, it's going to show up as an increase in our measured consumer price index level, and that's going to be reported as inflation. But strictly speaking, from an economic standpoint, we wouldn't really want to call that inflation. We want to say that that's a change in relative prices. So that's sort of a long way of going around it to say that I think what we've observed over the last three or years or so is a little bit of a mix of both. We definitely had some pure inflation, and then we also had some relative price changes. So I think we've had a mix of there.
When you look at that from the, you know, from a huge view, you know, it seems all mm-hmm. kind of nebulous in a way. But when you're looking at the standpoint of the consumer, you know, having to go and buy groceries for your family, I mean, how is that an offshoot of this, where the prices of groceries have gone up exponentially? Is it a supply chain, you know, running downhill, that that's the reason? Or is it out of alignment with what's going on? Because if they're saying the inflation, I don't know if they're saying it's dropped or not, but it seems the prices have gone up higher than what you would expect based on inflation rate, right?
Well, yeah. And so one more thing to be clear about. Inflation refers to when this average price level, the consumer price index, goes up. When over the last couple of years, when we've been saying that inflation is coming down, well, inflation is the rate of change in this price index. And so when inflation has fallen from 7% average for the entire year of 2022 to about 2.5% or 3% recently, well, that's been a decline of inflation from 7% to, say, 3%. And for a while in 2022, it was actually up to 9%. So the inflation rate has come down. Now, I think there's might be some confusion thinking that as inflation comes down, the prices would go back to where they were in, say, January of 2021. Mm-hmm. That would only happen if we'd have negative inflation or deflation. So one thing here is that when we say that inflation is declining or diminishing, we have to remember we're not actually saying prices are going down. When it's that rate of increase has gone down. So I think that's important to keep in mind, because you know people have been responding to this and saying, like, I don't see prices going back to where they were before. And yet economists and on the news, they're saying that inflation is going down. Those are both correct observations. We just have to remember what exactly we mean by this decline in inflation.
That's a great explanation for that, because I was in that category of, why aren't we seeing any changes? Now I understand. So negative inflation, when you're already positive, basically means nothing to the consumer. So how do we get into a deflation rate so that we can actually get relief? What do we need to see?
Well, I mean, economists would, I mean, we generally don't like to see in deflation. And again, deflation meaning a decline in the general price level, is that would the across the board rise in prices is usually attributable to the money supply, and a decline across the board decline in prices would also be the most likely attributable to a decline in the money supply. And we think that the declines in the money supply seem to have are at least often connected with some really bad economic times. So the only times we've seen really sort of sustained deflation in the 20th century was during the Great Depression. And so that's not good. And then there was a little bit of deflation during the Great Recession in 2008, early 2009. There was some overall decline in prices. So I think economists would say, I'm not sure we want to do the kind of thing that would require a decline in the average price level. Now, you can have changes in relative prices, and we do see some of this all the time. some goods become cheaper over time. You know, you think of like flat screen TVs. Mm-hmm. They become, you know, after they've been out on the market for a few years, the price tends to really drop. So when we would like to see, it's always great to see relative prices fall, because that's a signal that those goods are becoming more abundant. They can be produced at a lower cost, and that could translate into a reduction in our measured CPI. So it would be great if certain goods became more available, and so that their prices could fall naturally, that would be good. But engineering a decline in the average price level by, say, like trying to reduce the money supply, it would be something that I think most economists would say that's not what we want to do. So basically what they're saying is we're probably not going to want to go back in and try to erase that 20 or 25% increase in prices. The prices are just going to stay at a higher level. What we'd rather try to do is get price stability and so stop the a rise in prices. Or as the Federal Reserve has a target rate of about 2% inflation per year. So we're going to try to get down to inflation back in that 2% range or 2% or less and have a relative price stability.
So I think the average person would, again, want to know what levers, if any, can be pushed to decrease the interest rate. So that ripples through, right, to lower mortgage rates, cheaper to get money from banks, et cetera, something to help boost them or boost their capacity to expand. Because that seems to be, I don't know if it's connected or not, but how do we, gin that up? Because everything has just gone in a way that it's hard for an average person to buy a home, to pay for groceries. You know, the daily activities of living are become really difficult.
That's definitely true. And that's one of the areas, because, when you say that prices go up, that's all prices, including interest rates, because that's another type of prices. And in interest rates, then we have a complication, because there's what we call the nominal interest rate, the rate of interest that you'll see quoted for, like, say, a mortgage loan. Mm-hmm. And then what we would call the real interest rate. And the best way to think about the real interest rate is that value of money adjusted for the change in the price level. If somebody saves some money and then, is going to invest it or put it in the bank, and the bank's going to invest it in somewhere by giving loans out in the economy, the person who's saving that money probably wants some kind of reward for being patient and putting off consuming the goods. So they're saving and letting others and investing that money. They want some reward for that. They probably want that. What they probably have in mind is a reward in real terms, not just what we call nominal terms. You'd like to be able to get all your money back and have a little bit extra to buy some extra goods, more goods and services. When you're patient and you get your money back and you're ready to go out and spend, then you could have if you went out and spent now. So generally speaking, we would expect that most savers want to have some kind of return on their money. So they're looking for a real interest rate. When the price level goes up, well, people who are saving are getting paid back with dollars that are worth less, not worthless, but worth less than the dollars that they lent out. So we know that inflation tends to hurt the savers and at some level benefit the borrowers, or certainly the people who already had mortgage loans before interest rates went up and we've had this inflation. They're actually going to be able to pay back those mortgages with dollars that are worth less than probably the bank and the lenders were planning to get back before. Like back in the 1970s, with all the inflation you had there, that really benefited my parents. They had their mortgage locked in about 5% or 5.25% or whatever from back in the 1960s, and they got to pay off those mortgage payments with dollars that were worth a lot less than they were in the 1960s when they took out that loan. So interest rates are complicated in that you do have this effect. But the interest rates are prices, and when prices are rising generally, that's going to include rising nominal interest rates, because people have to charge more interest to make sure that they get back what they were actually saving.
On that note, let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Daniel Sutter. And before the break, I think you did a really nice job of giving us an overview of how economics work. It seems so complicated. It really does. I wanted to segue a little bit into planned economies, and it may be outside of the box here a bit, but planned economies versus things that just work on, you know, the cost of doing business, how people interact with each other in a very natural way. You know, we talked about price controls for groceries, for example, setting the price for supermarkets, which I know happened in Venezuela. And I do remember it didn't have a good outcome. So when they talk about that as if it's, you know, it works in a vacuum, and I don't think it actually does. But if you can explain to the listeners what a planned economy versus free market economy, the difference between the two, because isn't that the two basic mindsets here that maybe we're trying to push one way or the other?
Well, yeah, there are. But let's just go think about like our price controls, because as they relate to inflation, because I think, you know, a natural response that people might have when they see that the price of something is high is to say, or that prices are going up a lot, to say, well, why doesn't the government do something about this? Mm-hmm. And at one level, the government could, by passing a price control, trying to freeze the prices, try to prevent our prices from rising. But especially when you've got, you're talking about a general inflation and you've got too much, you know, money growth, that the money supply is increasing too fast, the rising prices are really a symptom, and they are not the cause. And so it would be trying to, when you think of like trying to address inflation through price controls, it's really like, I know, you're trying to address somebody's symptoms without addressing the fact that they're sick. It's like telling somebody who's sick with a fever, you're like, just don't feel bad. And if you don't feel bad, or don't take your temperature, and let's rig the thermometer to say that your temperature is 98.6, regardless of what it says, you'll see it's 98.6 and say, see, you're all better. But you're not all better. You still feel the fever. You know you're sick with that. And so rising prices at one level are just a symptom, especially when they're being driven by increases in the money supply that's causing a pure inflation. So when we get into price controls, they've frequently been tried. Yes, they were tried in Venezuela to try to prevent price controls. They were tried by President Nixon back in 1971, a wage and price freeze across the American economy in response to about 5% inflation at that time. They've been tried by governments throughout history. So, and especially with regard to inflation, it's just treating the symptom. The fact that the prices are rising are reflecting a lot of other forces in the economy, to somehow just say, if we don't let this price rise the way it's supposed to, somehow that will change all of the more fundamental issues that are going on in the economy, it is really misplaced. It's just like trying to prevent somebody from seeing what their fever happens to be.
Got you. So from the flip side, you know, we've seen movements in various states to set the living wage at these high rates, right? Has that helped the economy, or has it hurt the economy?
Well, certainly it doesn't. It has a very limited impact on the workers that are being affected by the increases in the prices. Because, like, when California was increasing the minimum wage for fast food workers to like $20 an hour, but minimum wages are another form of price control. In this case, it's a price a floor. They're trying to boost a price through government action as opposed to keep it low. Mm-hmm. But from that regard, it's the same thing of the government trying to just step in and criminalize charging a given price in the economy. In this case, trying to criminalize charging or paying too low of a wage per worker. But when it comes to minimum wages and living wages, there's an old saying among economists that the minimum wage is always zero. And we say that because a business could always choose not to hire somebody. So the minimum wage represents, in one sense, a very, very limited intervention by the government into the economy. All it's sort of saying is you can't hire somebody for less than X number of dollars per hour. You don't have to hire them. But if you hire them, you have to pay at least this amount of money. And economists, by contrast, we look at, we say, well, you know, when we think, well, what's determining people's wages in the market? Well, it would be supply and demand. But in particular, we would point to what's known as the value of the marginal product. It would take a few moments to explain that. But what we say, the marginal product is how much output, how much workers are doing for a firm. And then the value of that is, well, you have to multiply it by the price of whatever the workers are producing. So if you've got workers who are working for a company that paints people's houses, you think like, okay, how much of a job or how much painting can somebody do in an hour? And then how much do we charge for that? And then by that, you get like, okay, that's the value that this worker is creating. So when we look across the economy, our model, I believe how we think wages are getting determined in the market is based on this the amount of value that workers are creating for firms. Because then firms will compete for workers, and because when they compete for workers, they're going to be forced to, the wages will get bid up to this level where firms are paying workers the value of what they're creating for their firms. And so therefore, from that perspective, when we look at people who are not earning enough money in some sense from their job, we'd say the problem is that these individuals are not productive enough. They need to be able to have skills that allow them to create more value for businesses, because if they have more valuable skills, then businesses can afford to pay them more. And from that perspective, a minimum wage does nothing to address that problem. So, economists would be saying the problem of low wages is people don't have enough marketable skills to be able to create enough value for businesses. And simply in that case, you're trying to say, well, businesses have to pay more, doesn't do anything to address that issue of skills. And if you give me a moment here, let me go a little further, it actually can be quite counterproductive, because for many workers, especially if you don't go to college, then one of the places people learn valuable labor skills is actually working for businesses. Very few workers in our economy work for the minimum wage, about 2 or 3%. Work for minimum wage. That means 97 or 98% of workers get paid more than the minimum wage. Why is that? Well, because they have skills that allow them to get paid. Well, for many workers who are going to join the labor force, especially if you're a teenager and you haven't been to college, you haven't been able to train to be an accountant or an economist or an engineer, then you're entering the labor force, you may not have a lot of marketable skills. But there's an amazing thing that happens when somebody starts to work for a business and the business sees that this person is reliable and they'll show up on work, and they can start to train the person. As they train the person, they can train them for more and more involved jobs at their workplace. And as they train for more and more involved jobs, that they get raises, they get promotions. Mm-hmm. And so for many people, getting into the labor force is the key to getting skills to be able to make more than the minimum wage. But the minimum wage has this really, really bad effect of stepping in and keeping the people who have the least skills perhaps from getting into the labor market at all. They never get their foot in the door. And if you've gone to poorly performing public schools and you didn't go to college and you start wondering, well, where are you going to get any kind of marketable labor skills? It's going to be working for a business. Work for them for a while and they'll train you. But if you don't get to start, you don't get to get any training.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I remember when I was in high school and grade school, I mean, the jobs, especially the fast food industry, were usually kids who were teens who were working for extra money, spending money. It wasn't raising a family of four on it. And you just described the power of that pathway, because it taught skills, because it allowed them to see what direction they wanted to go in, but also it wasn't stagnant. So you described how people could pull themselves up from relatively naive in terms of not knowing much to gaining skills. And that begs the question now, and we may have to go into the next break, but how does AI throw a wrench in this? So if you have robots taking over a lot of the menial jobs and tasks, what does that do to the economy in terms of people, in terms of labor, and how people feel about being productive and having a purpose?
Well, I think it's gonna it's not gonna hurt as much. It's not gonna cause as much disruption as you might think. Although it might take me a little bit to explain why I think this is gonna be true.
Please
But
go.
if I mean, I could do it now, or if you sort of tease here and say we'll have a good answer to this after the break, if you'd rather do that.
No, let's wait on the break, because now
Okay.
we're on,
All
we're
right. Great.
cooking.
All right. No problem, man. No problem. Okay. It's good. I think AI is not going to eliminate jobs altogether. And the reason for that is that jobs in the economy are ultimately come down to tasks that people would like to have done. And they would like to have somebody else do them for them if possible. And because a market economy is based on voluntary interactions, nobody is allowed to just force somebody to do these tasks for them. You have to pay them to do tasks. And so AI, just as with robots before that and machines before that, I mean, think of like a steam shovel can replace a lot of people having to dig a hole or a ditch with shovels and pickaxes. So as we come up with tools that allow us to do certain tasks that we've had to do before by hand, or we have an individual there like doing the accounting or answering some questions about the law. As we come up with a way to automate some of the any task, especially tasks that get repeated a lot and often come up in the economy. So those are the ones that it makes sense to try to automate in some way or another. That just frees up our time, and that frees up time and resources to go ahead and do other things. And people always have more tasks that they want to have done in their lives. And so if there are ones that you can get done faster or less expensive at a lower expense than before, you can afford to then go down to the next thing on your to-do list and say, can I pay somebody to do this for me now? And that's where jobs come from. So as some jobs get automated, that really, from the very big picture, simply means that we have more time, because ultimately, of all the different natural resources out there, it's probably human time and effort that's most scarce. We free up more time and effort that's available to do other tasks. And because when AI automates a task, it can be done at a lower cost. The people who are previously paying, say, a lawyer to answer their legal questions, when you get AI up to and able to answer a lot of standard kind of legal questions for somebody, then that should be less expensive than paying a lawyer $150 an hour or whatever to answer your questions for you. That means that that person has more money left over, and they can, again, they can afford to say, well, what else, since I don't have to pay so much for a lawyer or accountant or other services out there, what else could I happen to pay for now? And that creates new jobs, that creates the ability to pay for new tasks, which then get turned into new kinds of jobs.
That's an excellent response. And let's take our second break, because I want to ask you the segue to that. We talked about automation. I want to ask you about sustainable income. So let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter, and you can go to a website, yellowhammer.com, and also how can they listen to your conversations? It's on a television channel, right?
It's on YouTube. So if you search for e-conversations Troy Trojan Vision, because it's on the Troy University cable station, e-conversations Troy Trojan Vision on YouTube, and you should get the playlist.
Excellent. Now, let's backtrack, because you just, you know, allayed my fears about AI and robots. What about sustainable income? Because the first side of this is people are still motivated to partake of society and enter it and offer something. What happens if you're just given some money? Does that stop that process? Does it affect it?
Well, yeah, that definitely is an issue. And so if you think of like efforts to perhaps give people some kind of a universal basic income from the government, I mean, one of the reasons why people work is obviously because the goods and services we need to survive, we have to pay for, because mm-hmm. we have this voluntary economy. And so the goods and services that we need to live, to, you know, the food and clothing and housing, those all have to be produced, and somebody has to produce them. And they're not going to produce them for us just, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts. We need to compensate them. If we want them to do something for us, we have to compensate them. And, you know, that means in almost all cases, unless you happen to inherit a bunch of wealth or own a bunch of minerals that you can sell, that means we have to work. We have to work for our living. And that's really what our market economy is based off of. We start with people buy in or accept this idea that you have to work to get the income that you're going to need to buy the goods and services that you need and want. And so if people were able to get, if people had money without having to work, it could definitely undermine their willingness to work. Now, at one level, markets are great and the labor market is great. Nobody has to work if they choose not to. There's no like law of the government you're violating by not working. Unless you are independently wealthy, the flip side of it is you won't have very much money to spend to buy the goods and services you need. So, you know, everybody's free to choose, you know, in effect, how hard they want to work, assuming there are jobs available. So leaving aside the macroeconomic part of this, if there are jobs available, people at some level are free to choose. You know, you can work a second job if you want. You can try to work lots of overtime. You can try to increase your number of hours you're working, or, you know, you can try to get a raise and train yourself to be able to get a higher paying job, or you could choose to work less. And I think, you know, it's at one level, since everything's voluntary, the person who chooses like to not work a lot for, you know, work and make a lot of money, but at the same time willing to live a relatively Spartan income, a lifestyle, like say somebody who wants to live on the short North Shore of Hawaii and go surfing all the time, and they really just they don't care to make a lot of money. They can live very sparsely, but they just love to be out surfing. That's a perfectly legitimate choice for people to make. So people are perfectly, you know, can choose to work less. So I don't want to say that I'm criticizing everybody who's not going to, like, you know, willing to work 40, 50, 70 hours a week. But we do need to have people be understand and accept that they have to be willing to work, that the rules are sort of that you have to work for a living in general. And I do think that that's a very important point, and it's one that I think the necessity of work is trying to be, there are forces trying to look to undermine that and make people think that, well, maybe we should relieve people of this necessity of working and maybe just let the government step in and provide everybody with money to free them from having to work in some sense to support themselves.
Well, you just described and said something really potent, and that is the freedom to either work or not, to have a second job, to do what you want, to put yourself on an economic path that you choose. To me, if the government is pronouncing how much money you get and you have this portion, then what can possibly you have, what would you have to do for that portion, right? It seems to me that you can lose your freedom because you have to toe some sort of line to get it. And if you don't get it, you have no other mechanism of making money. So to me, it's a catch-22, perhaps.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. And I think, you know, when you look at socialist or communist countries, Lenin at the start of the Soviet Union famously said something, he who does not work will not eat. And so, you know, the idea that somehow the government's always going to have money to hand out for people. The government has nothing to hand out unless somebody produces it and the government's able to get their hands on it. And we live in this world of scarcity, and all the goods and services that we want to consume have to be produced by somebody. And so, and then when you start to think about just handing people money doesn't mean that there's creating cash. And handing cash to people doesn't mean there's necessarily any goods and services for people to go buy. So it's one of those things, given that there are goods and services out there, if you or I or somebody else gets some more money from the government, some more cash from the government, well, we can afford to go out and buy more goods and services than we could before. But as you start giving lots of people cash and fewer people are working, there are fewer real goods and services out there. And so, you know, to be able to have anything to buy, somebody's got to produce them. So I think in the near term, I think that, you know, there are forces that, and there may be groups that are trying to undermine the labor market, but undermine people's willingness to work with the lure or the promise of, oh, the government will just provide you with everything and then you won't have to work. But if that goes too far and too many people stop working, well, I strongly suspect that at some point that the government will step in, because ultimately they say, well, the government's giving you this money. You're going to have to do tasks that the government commands you to do.
I mean, that's the logical extension, especially since you're describing a system that it's eventually a lack. You know, you start off with maybe enough for everybody, but at some point there isn't enough. And then it becomes dog eat dog to a degree.
Exactly. Yeah. And everything has to be produced, and somebody has to produce it. And, you know, I think sometimes we forget what a wonderful thing that the labor market in a modern market economy is, because that whole process of working or choosing to work or choosing not to work or how hard to work or somebody wanting something done, it's all done through voluntary persuasion and by paying people. And throughout most of human history, you go back, most of human history, people who want stuff done have tried to command or force others to work for them, to do this work for them without compensating them. The labor market is really based on this, like, moral equality of all people. Nobody's, you know, it's not like the Pharaoh can order the slaves to build the pyramids, you know, whether they want to or not. If Bill Gates or Elon Musk want something done, they have to pay people to do it, for whether it's like manicure the lawn at their mansions or, you know, wash one of their cars. They have to pay somebody. They can't force anybody to work for it. The labor market is this great and wonderful thing because it's all based on voluntary interaction. And therefore, there's also this principle that nobody's better than another. If somebody wants somebody to do something for them, they have to give them something in exchange. They can't force them. They can't make them. There's no bringing out a whip and forcing somebody to work for you anymore. We've abolished all that. We've got this great thing called the labor market.
I couldn't have said it better. On that note, let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter, and you did a great job, of describing, you know, all the glitters kind of thing. There's nothing for free. At some point, you're going to pay a price for it, and you may not want to. So let's think about it, the flip side with taxing. Is there more power in taxing people less so they can spend their money in the way they deem that they want to spend it? Wouldn't that actually juice the economy more if people had more money in their pocket to spend?
I think that's definitely true, and because we can only spend out of the money that we have left over after paying taxes, or what the economists would call our disposable income, our after-tax income. And sometimes when you think about the pain of inflation, is sometimes like inflation actually artificially increases our taxes in some complicated ways. The more money that people get to keep net of taxes, the more that they get to spend. And one thing that's great about that is that when you or I or one of your listeners has money and we get to spend it ourselves, we're spending that money on things we want directly. We for sure want. We don't go out and buy stuff that we have no interest in using or consuming. As government spends more money for us, well, the government spends on stuff that like Congress or your state legislature or local city council decides to choose to spend money on. And that may or may not be things that all of us support spending money on. And so when we're spending the money ourselves, we are getting stuff that we know we're going to want. As government spends more, there's a very real chance we're getting stuff that we wouldn't want, that we wouldn't want to buy ourselves, or we wouldn't necessarily want. The government can be spending some stuff that isn't really very desired by everybody, or maybe desired by some people, but not by everybody. And then also the government can sometimes spend money in wasteful ways. Now, that's not to say the government also can spend some money on some very good things that we would be happy to pay taxes on, because when the government is going to provide for roads or police and courts, that creates benefits. And I think if anything, we've seen some evidence over the last few years of the costs of not having enough police or not having a functioning court system to protect people from criminals who would steal from them. So government can do some good things, but there is sort of also this issue that when we spend our money ourselves, we generally want to make sure that we are getting things that we value and that we tend not to waste our money. The government can sometimes spend money in very wasteful fashions. And then sometimes it's hard to even know how the government's spending their money. I just saw a news story saying that the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, had failed their seventh straight audit. So they can't even like report what they're doing with all the money that they get, all the taxpayer money that they get. And if we don't even know if they can't even tell us what they're spending it on, then we have no guarantee to know that they're spending on stuff. Everything that they're spending it on is all stuff that we as taxpayers would really like them to spend on. So yeah, the economy can be stronger in some ways, but more importantly, like, we have this mechanism, we can sort of be sure when people are spending money themselves, their own money on themselves, they're almost surely going to get some value from it. And that's not guaranteed when the government's spending money.
I think that's a great answer. And I mean, ultimately, the more it's like they have to have a reason to exist, right? So the bigger the government, the more money it needs. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're going to be taxed more to run this show. And I mean, the pendulum seemed to have swung quite a bit with just bloated new, departments making it's just a sinkhole essentially of money. How do we take our power back in this sense? Would like what's being proposed now, let's not taxing Social Security benefits or not taxing tips, would that be a small way, an easy way to start the process of having us keep what we earn and what we work for?
Yeah, and I think economists are of two minds with this. One thing, we don't like to see a lot of things exempted from taxes. We I think we prefer to see tax rates across the board come down. And so in one sense, if you tax some things very highly and then give exempt certain things from taxes, you're really giving a big boost or incentive to that type of behavior. So, you know, for instance, if we're going to eliminate taxes on tips, then, you know, clearly many workers would sort of want to get paid with tips, right? So you could move to of saying like, okay, we're not going to pay our employees whatever, we'll just let them rely on tips. And of course the employees would like that because anything they get in tips would be that way. But there's no reason to systematic from a policy standpoint to really sort of say, oh, everybody should get paid with tips as opposed to through like employment and getting paid a wage that you know in advance, because like maybe you wouldn't get a lot of tips and like you wouldn't make very much money in a month, as opposed to if you know you're getting paid a certain amount every 2 weeks or every month, you can plan better. So, you know, they're amongst economists, we'd sort of like to see tax rates overall be lower and then not exempt things. But the flip side of it is that we pay a lot in taxes and we don't necessarily get a lot back from that. And so we should probably take any tax cut that comes along, and so we should never throw back a tax cut if at some level if our politicians seem to be willing to say, okay, we'll cut taxes on this. You know, my dad used to say, beggars can't be choosers. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. They're willing to let you keep some more of your money. So maybe we don't want to say like, no, don't do that. Let only. You know, let's throw that back and hope we get across the board lower tax rates. But yeah, lower tax rates overall would certainly be probably the preferred economic outcome.
And would it be fairer, if you want to talk about fairness, about having a national tax? You know, a national, I don't know, a tax on whatever you buy kind of thing, but it's flat. Would that make a difference for everybody?
Like a consumption tax as opposed to income tax. Mm-hmm. You know, many economists would prefer a consumption tax to an income tax. And the reason to sort of see that is the short version of in economics, if you tax anything, you get less of it. Now, the government has to do some good things for us. It has to provide police and courts and some other really important things that we can't really live without. But that money that they're going to have to collect, they have to collect through some kind of taxes. And so if you just think of this rule, if we tax anything, we get less of it. Do we want to see less income generation, or would we like to, on the margin, see people maybe consume less and maybe save a little bit more? Because if you're taxing consumption, then, you know, then people should probably maybe save a little bit more instead. So, if we tax income, we see less income. That means people are earning less income. That means we're generating less income overall in the country. And so when we tax income and we give people less of an incentive to work, there's less work going on and less production going on. And so economists would sort of, if we could, you know, prefer to, you know, perhaps tax consumption over income. And so you could tax consumption through like a sales tax or sales taxes of that nature, but we could also modify our income tax if we really wanted to really sort of turn it into a consumption tax.
With that in mind, then everybody would it be a level playing field? I mean, for people who don't have a lot of means, for example, it wouldn't be that they're necessarily paying more than they're paying now, correct?
Correct. Yeah, because especially and if you're concerned about, you know, having a progressive tax system. Well, the problem is that for a sales tax is actually pretty regressive. It hits people who earn less money harder. But if we wanted to modify our income tax, we could actually turn it into a consumption tax fairly easily. All you'd have to do is exempt savings. Income goes into either savings or consumption. And so if we tax instead of income, if we were to exempt savings, it actually becomes a consumption tax. And then you can have higher interest rates or higher tax rates on like higher levels of consumption. So you could retain the progressive nature of our income tax and get away from the problem that you'd have with the sales tax, is that the people in the lowest income brackets would pay a relatively high share of a strict sales tax.
And is there any benefit to restructuring corporate tax versus an individual's tax? Because they're making, I mean, I understand they pay payroll taxes, so they're not paying nothing. But if you know how to work the system, you can not pay anything. Am I correct? If you're a corporate.
Well, yeah. There's certainly that. One of the issues is that we have very, the U.S., before the Trump tax cuts back in 2017, we had like the highest corporate income tax of any developed country. We were right up at the top. But many corporations don't pay a lot because it's a high tax rate with lots of things to do to sort of like avoid paying taxes. And that's not a very good system because people are, what you're really sort of doing then is incentivizing loopholes and tax attorneys. And those things aren't ultimately very productive. I personally don't like the idea of taxing businesses generally, because businesses are ultimately just the individuals. There's no corporation out there that's paying the tax. The business is made up of the individuals who are participating in this, the employees, the investors, and sometimes even the customers who are paying for those goods. So when you tax businesses, you have this appearance that somehow, you're just taxing the big capitalists, the Wall Street fat cats. But economically, we have to go and look and see who actually pays these taxes. And in many cases, it could be consumers through higher prices. It could be workers through lower wages. And many times it's hard to even know. We're economists ourselves here would be hard-pressed to tell you who's truly paying some of these taxes. I think politicians like the idea of making it appear that people aren't paying these taxes, just the capitalists are paying the taxes when we tax businesses. But it's really very unclear. And I think we could do a much better. I would be in favor of eliminating taxes on businesses per se directly and taxing consumption or income or other things where it's just clearer who's paying the tax, as opposed to this sort of like game that you make it appear. So people would support corporate taxes because you're sure somebody else is paying it. But maybe that's not actually true, and maybe you're actually paying more of that tax than you think, and that's just a game I think politicians are trying to play against us.
I mean, it's so opaque that they are able to use emotion most of the time to make people work against their own interest. You know, time goes way too quickly. It was a great conversation. I'm sure we just scratched the surface of a ton of things, but I wanted to make sure people know how to listen to your podcast and read what you write.
Yeah, so I write at yellowhammer.com and then 1819news.com. And then eConversations, the Troy Trojan Vision for the TV show. It's up there. It's also available as a podcast, but it's available, the shows are on YouTube. You can watch them there.
Dr. Sutter, it was a pleasure having a conversation with you today. You were really awesome. I think people have a much better feel now, hopefully. I certainly do. You're a great teacher. So I wanted to thank you again for joining me.
And thank you for having me on, Dr. George. My pleasure to come on the show.
Oh, I look forward to the future. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and thank you for everything you do.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.